The ICC invited Chris Knight of the Radical Anthropology Group to take part in its discussions, and in particular, to contribute as a scientist, a Marxist, and an anthropologist to the Congress debate on Marxism and science. During a break in the Congress, Chris launched into an informal and wide-ranging discussion with one of the translating team. And as something of an experiment on our side, we thought we'd record this discussion and see if anything useful could be brought out of it that would be of interest to our readers and now perhaps our listeners. We certainly found it an interesting experience, and we hope that our listeners will agree with us. On a couple of technical points, with regard to what you're about to hear, first of all, the recording was made out of doors and under a flight path. We weren't aware of this at the time, so the conversation is occasionally overlaid with birdsong and, less poetically, with aircraft passing overhead. We hope that won't be too much of a distraction. Secondly, the discussion or conversation went on for some time, and so we decided to break it down into roughly half-hour parts, we hope fairly logically, on the basis of the different subjects that were covered. In this first part of the discussion, we're looking at some of the questions put forward in Chris Knight's book, Blood Relations, which really go to the heart of the whole question of primitive communism, a question which has been of enormous importance for revolutionaries and for Marxists ever since Marx and Engels in particular discovered the work of Lewis Morgan in the 19th century. And the whole question of primitive communism, of course, is intimately linked to the question of what is human nature? What is this creature that we call Homo sapiens, of which we are part? What was the original human society like? Where did it come from? And in consequence, what kind of lessons can we draw as to what should be the communist human society of the future that we hope will replace the demonstrably inhuman capitalist society that we live in today? Oh yes, and of course, every self-respecting podcast ought to have a theme tune, so we've chosen one too. The one we've chosen is an extract from Vieux Farcatore's Bamako Jam that you can find on YouTube if you're interested.
There's one, just to sort of thinking about the thing I was running past you before. I mean, this guy Darmojat's book, like I say, it's got some interesting stuff in it, but and he's obviously very knowledgeable about ethnology, current ethnology, I'd say, but he seems to me to be much weaker as soon as he starts talking about anything beyond what we can actually see today. And in particular, it seems to me really exaggerated, I'd say, to just refer to your theory in a paragraph and say, well, it makes a lot of fundamental methodological errors. And the fundamental methodological error, in his view, is treating myth as something serious that can really tell you something about previous societies or pre-historical societies. Because if you think of present-day hunter-gatherers, in a sense, they're historical societies because we can write history about them. I think that's an interesting discussion in itself. How far can you actually draw something from myth? I mean, he simply rejects it out of hand, which seems to me completely unjustifiable. You have to at least argue.
The thing is that magico-religious mythology is the most conservative level of human consciousness and activity. You've only got to think of, say, Christianity, a story about a man who dies, 3 days, and comes alive again, and is the Lamb of God, and all those things. I mean, since this happened, we've had the collapse of the Roman Empire, we've had the Dark Ages, we've had feudalism, we've had Renaissance, we've had the Industrial Revolution, and the same story is still around. If you go to Aboriginal Australia, you'll find the story of the rainbow snake. And it's been traced back at least to the time of the flood, to the melting of the glaciers and the last, you know, the end of the last ice age.
Traced back in terms of artistic.
We've actually got rock paintings of the rainbow snake, and they've been dated.
Mm.
So, if mythology is conservative, if it doesn't change, if it's time resistant, it must contain information about previous times. It's just by definition, you know.
Seems logical.
So, and then you've got the fact that Claude Lévi-Strauss is by far the greatest scholar to have done anything remotely scientific in relationship to myth. I mean, compare with Freud or Jung, I mean, Lévi-Strauss is an absolute giant. And his book Mythologique is a huge achievement, massive tour de force. He studies 1,000 myths of North and South America.
Hmm.
And comes up with the conclusion that at the level of the underlying grammar, the underlying logic of all these stories, there's just one myth. And it's life, death, and resurrection. Or it's this world and the other world, the earth and the sky and the battle between them. But at the end of the day, it's one story, it's one myth in all its different versions. So where did that come from?
Mm.
There's only two possible explanations. One is Lévi-Strauss's own, which is that the brain is hardwired, to limit us to that one myth, those variations on a theme. And the other's, I think, much more plausible. And Lévi-Strauss considers it and maybe accepts it, but that basic universal grammar of mythology has something to do with the way in which human language, religion, culture, kinship originated. And I would certainly say that if you can't find any information in those myths, that's your fault. It doesn't mean they're uninformative. I mean, everything's informative about the past. I mean, nothing in the present is there just by chance. The present is linked to the past. The past made the present. And if we can't reconstruct the past from mythology, from kinship, from archaeology, from rock art, from genetics and stuff, that's our problem. It doesn't mean that this data isn't informative. It just means we haven't worked out how to decode it.
Yeah.
And mythology, like everything else, is something which we need to decode. And a theory of the origins of culture should be testable in the light of evidence. And a theory of the origin of symbolic culture, I say it should be testable in the light of the symbolic evidence, which of course includes mythology. So I don't know what on earth he's talking about. And I must say, unless he's referring to Lévi-Strauss and so on, if he's just ignorant of all that, it doesn't augur well. It doesn't look good. It sounds to me like he's just decided he doesn't like this particular theory, and that's it. I mean, the fact that somebody doesn't like a theory is interesting. It tells me something about that particular person, but it's of no scientific interest.
Mm. My feeling, I mean, it's why it's interesting in a discussion on Marxism and science, and therefore the way in which you approach science. Again, with all the caveats possible, in that I'm not an expert in anything, so these are kind of an interested amateur's remarks more than anything else. But my feeling is that he sins by empiricism. Now, it's basically, his book is interesting because it's a collection of interesting facts about different tribes. But it just strings together a whole series of facts. And he spends most of his time knocking down other people's theories.
That kind of pseudo-empiricism is of no particular value. I just coming back to the mythology thing. If this guy is supposed to be a Marxist, he should maybe acquaint himself with Engels and the Origin of the Family, in particular his introduction, where Engels goes through Backofen, one of the great sources on all this stuff, and takes some of Backofen's interpretations of Greek mythology. And Engels is celebrating that stuff and definitely thinks of mythology, in the case of Greek mythology, as significant and informative about past stages of human development.
I mean, one of the things I remember in Dharmacher's book is saying, well, and all this stuff about the mythology telling you something about the previous society. In fact, all it is that there's a justification for male domination.
Well, that's very true.
But that's all it is. And it's almost as if you could invent any story to justify domination. It says, look at the Bible, for example. Yeah. And the Bible is a justification for male domination, but it doesn't talk about it. Would you say, if you look at the Bible, does that tell you something about prehistoric Jewish society.
Of course it does. It's hugely informative. No, it's a huge encyclopedia. The Old Testament is a massive encyclopedia.
Oh.
It's ideology on one level, but as you say, there are constraints as to what is possible in ideology and what's not. And the fact that world mythology is basically male ideology, I totally agree with. Of course, I agree. That's the point I make all the time. But at another level, there's some constant structure which, in the case of male ideology, is obviously designed to make the point that women couldn't possibly rule the world, or if they did rule the world, it would be disaster, and male dominance and terrorism, as it sometimes is all justified. But then how they justify their rule is very interesting. I mean, the myths of matriarchy, they basically say that when women had the power, they used unfair methods. They used to get together in a lodge with witchcraft and in league with the moon, and they used to use like magic against men to get men to do things. And yes, of course, that is what women were doing. I mean, there's no question. And then men say that as it was also unfair, they had to find out the women's secrets. They had to get into this hut, which is, of course, a menstrual hut, steal women's secrets from under their skirts or by looking under some hidden place and discovering the sacred flutes or something. And then the men had to then get up their courage to attack the women, kill them, turn them into animals, destroy their lodge, produce another lodge, a men's hut in place, and then the men had to start menstruating themselves in various artificial ways in order to prove that they could be as good as women were. I mean, all that is really telling us something about the initial situation and about where women's power really stemmed from.
Well, I must admit, when I read Dharmaj's thing, I thought, well, okay, but if I was a primitive man and all I was doing was inventing a story to justify male domination, why on earth would I go through this business of having male menstruation? When I read your book, this was the first time I'd heard of it, and I thought, why would you invent something so bizarre to justify male domination? There must be something more to it than that.
Have you noticed that all Aboriginal male initiation rites involve this idea that men can menstruate? And then you go around the world, you go to Africa, Amazonia, anywhere you like. Whenever you have a male monopoly of ritual power, and the males, the young boys, when they come of age, they have to go through this initiation. You'll find that they have to bleed through the nose, through the ear, one way or another. And then you discover that they call it male menstruation. And then you discover that this is their answer to female menstruation. It's extraordinary. And also, equally extraordinary, is the fact that the bourgeois anthropologists and, evolutionary scientists, they've got nothing to say. They just ignore it. They can't even cope with the paradox. I've got a theory. Could be right, could be wrong, but at least it's a theory. Seems to me to make a lot of sense. Everyone who's read my book seems to think, well, it's more or less the only theory we've got, really. I mean, why else would men menstruate if it wasn't like the grammar of ritual power, which if men wanted to usurp that power, they had to manage to do themselves?
Yeah.
But, I mean, show me another theory. Don't just ignore the data.
Well, there's another thing I liked about the way you presented it, is that you put forward the principle of scientific parsimony, I find that a very intriguing idea. As I go back to the book I've been reading on superstring theory, and my understanding of exactly what... It's a very good vulgarization, but my understanding of what he says is so-so. But he's talking about the idea of supersymmetry in theoretical physics. I won't try and...
I know a little bit about it, so it's
bring
okay,
up
yeah,
what
yeah,
supersymmetry
yeah,
actually
yeah,
is,
yeah,
but
yeah.
One of the points he makes is that, well, we've not been able really to demonstrate that there's supersymmetry right the way through the whole theory, but it just doesn't feel right that it should be. But why would nature be symmetrical only in a bit of it and not in the whole of it? Now, that's a very interesting thought, because it's something which is, it's almost an intuition. And it's not justified by the mathematics. It's not justified by observation, because there is no observation at the level of superstring theory. It's about a billion times smaller than it's possible to observe anything at the moment. So that then plugs into the idea of the human mind itself. There is something in the human mind that needs to impose theoretical order on the world around it. And that theoretical order, it almost has to be beautiful. if I can use that word.
Yeah, I totally agree, and you're the first reader of my book that I'm aware of, that I've met and talked to, who's picked up on that, actually, and it is, for me, the most satisfying thing about the whole theory. I mean, in the late 19th century, you had these armchair theorists, many of them inspired by Darwin. So Darwin had explained a lot of stuff, but what about marriage? What about language? What about kinship? You know, so you had a theory of the origin of language. You had a theory, I mean, lots of theories. You had a lot of other people think, well, we also need another theory. Let's have a theory of the origin of marriage. Mm-hmm. Oh, maybe another theory. Maybe the theory of the origin of music or art or labor or something. And there were so many different theories. Then, of course, and you know, what on earth are you supposed to do with all these theories? And so, obviously, you had a big reaction against all that, and you just had this functionalist stuff, and let's just find out how societies actually function. Let's, you know, what's the function?
Yeah, yeah.
Kingship or, you know, whatever. So, I'm just saying, actually, it's all a lot simpler than that. Supposing that as our species was becoming culturally and socially and cognitively human, maybe supposing you didn't have a thing called the economy, another thing called the religious level, another thing called the linguistics, supposing it was much simpler than that, and supposing one thing, one action, one intervention was simultaneously linguistic, religious, kinship, economic, all at once, because these separate spheres are where we live. We have a thing called the economy. Maybe hunters and gatherers don't have the economy. We have a thing called religion. Well, maybe hunter-gatherers don't have a thing, religion, which is separate from the economics. Maybe we have a thing called language. Maybe they did, maybe their language was, you know, on the same plane as, you know, their religion and everything else. So I just had this insight, which I think is, you know, as you say, I mean, it's very, you know, parsimonious and beautiful, that this intervention by the oppressed sex, the revolutionary sex, signaling, right, we're not available. We're saying no. No sex. I mean, supposing that action was linguistic, because it was saying something. It was kinship, because it was defining, you know, a collective of kin, as opposed to those outside that collective that they were aiming their signal at. Supposing it was religious, because they were just saying, well, actually, we're sacred. Supposing economic, in the sense that we're now activating, you know, a moment of production, that men are going to go out hunting. Supposing it was cosmological. Supposing all these levels, which we think are separate, were actually telescoped and collapsed into one, and you only need a theory for that one thing. Okay, I'm just saying, well, let's try it out. I think it works. No one's come up with any data to contradict my theory.
No.
Everyone that's explored the theory has been very excited about it. Most people that have explored it, you know, have gone off on their own and are starting to develop it in various different directions. The people who oppose the theory, mostly, as far as I can work out, the people who just say, I don't really like this theory and I'm not going to read about it. So they don't even go through it. They didn't, you know, fair enough. If you don't like the theory, it's interesting about yourself. Just not liking a theory is of no scientific interest. Not at all. It just tells me what your likes and dislikes are. It's what Dawkins calls the argument from personal distaste. I mean, so what? I mean,
argument from prejudice.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, yes, I mean, that's one of the things. I mean, I'm not sure if it's appropriate to say that, but it's the physicists have been looking for years and years. I mean, ever since they realized that quantum gravity and general relativity, the quantum mechanics and general relativity actually pose a real problem.
You have to reconcile them at the lowest level.
And that somewhere you have to look for something which allows you to solve that problem. And I, you know, when I read your book, I was thinking, this is an attempt at a grand unified theory of human evolution.
I call it the theory of everything.
That
makes us human.
It's
a theory of everything, because it, whether it's right or wrong is another issue. But I mean, the theory is saying that in order to understand everything about us humans, about everything about history, you know, history of kinship and economics and astronomy and science and language and religion and all that stuff, we need to know how it all started. And when it started, it could have been very simple. It was a group of hunters and gatherers who got... okay, another way of saying it. At the point of beginning, you had a number of things. You have, like, humans, we're not unisex, we come in two kinds, only one of which gets pregnant, males and females. Okay, so you've got males and females. And out there, you've got food which moves the food which is rooted. You've got plants and animals. You've got, you know, the sun and the moon. You've got a number of ingredients, plus, you know, you can say they're actually quite limited. Okay, now make it work. Take males and females, plants and animals, sun and moon, a few other things, you know, make it work. Live, survive, get your genes into the future. I'm just suggesting there's not an infinite number of ways of doing that. Probably there's actually only one way of solving the conundrum of how do you, with those ingredients, how do you make a viable way of life and survive and get your genes, you know, get your children, you know, fed and clothed so that they can reproduce in their turn. I'm suggesting at the beginning it was actually, you know, on balance, really only one way of doing it. And that was the way that we did. And, I think we can reconstruct what happened. Hunting at full moon, staying in at home, you know, dark moon, because otherwise you'd get eaten by a lion. Waxing versus waning, males versus females, all that stuff. Very, very simple. And then you look at the mythology and you find, okay, it seems to work. We die, we're reborn, it seems to be linked with the moon. A number of things you can say about waxing moon, you know, a number of things you can say about waning moon. You can easily test it all. You can just take that what I'm calling the time-resistant syntax of world mythology and see if there's a fairy tale that violates it. I could go into it a little bit. I mean, if you found me a single story where Jack or any other hero goes into the other world and he's eating roast beef, I'd be amazed, because it would contradict my thesis. When you're dead, you shouldn't be eating cooked meat. You should be, you know, hungry. If there is any sex, it should be incest, not marriage. If there's any mention of wet or dry, it should be wet. So there's a whole lot of things. If it's about noise, yes, there should definitely be, you know, cacophonous sounds associated with death, but not with marriage and honeymoon and all that stuff. You know, and lo and behold, you take, I don't know, Rapunzel, Rumpelstiltskin, Sleeping Beauty, Little Red Riding Hood, Cinderella, Jack and the Beanstalk, and absolutely with total fidelity, the syntax is respected, as, of course, Levi-Strauss has already showed with 1,000 Myths from North and South America. Well, I mean, that must mean something.
Something. Everything has a significance. Everything has a place in...
And Levi-Strauss had this beautiful thing. He said, you'd think, wouldn't you? He says, you'd think that in mythology, anything can happen. You could just make it up. You don't have to worry about gravity or, you know, laws of biology. You can just say, oh, he died and he come alive again. So Levi-Strauss says, if even in that sphere you have the rule of law, you have scientific constraints as rigorous as those which apply to the physical world or to chemistry, then that's very significant. That's telling you we can do a science of mythology. I think we can indeed do a science of mythology, and the science is not too different from physical science or chemistry or something. There are actual laws which we can discover applying to the level of mythology. Very, very, very rigorous constraints apply. Extraordinary.
How would you describe laws about mythology? I mean, that's an interesting idea for me.
Okay, it's very simple. If the theory is right, then it all began not with a myth, but with a way of life. And the way of life was, every dark moon we die. We die as biological beings, as individuals, as spouses. We die as, you know, all that. Like, this world has ended, and now we come alive again in a collective, where it doesn't matter so much whether we're male or female. We're all brothers and sisters. There aren't any husbands and wives. We've died to that world. We're in a different world. We're secluded. We're united by blood. And this lasts for 2 weeks. And if there is any intimacy, it's going to be intimacy within the blood. There's going to be, you know, like a lot of very powerful signaling going on. You wouldn't really expect language, because, you know, it's a period for ritual solidarity. And you wouldn't expect people to be cooking meat, because we haven't got any meat yet, because we're on strike in order to get the meat. So and now, okay, in this logic of life, using the moon as your clock, you're approaching full moon, you're going out hunting, you're surrounding the game, you're maybe, you know, finding out where it is, you're killing it, you're bringing it back home, and now at full moon, ideally, okay, you're lighting the cooking fires, you're removing the polluting blood from the meat. You're liberated now from this collective. You don't need it anymore. You can let go. You can re-emerge now as individuals. You know, a man could be a man. Like he can want sex with one woman, not with a whole collective. You know, and so you come alive as as you know, biological individuals, and you've died as you know, as brothers and sisters within this great collective. Okay, so we got time bisected, and we have a syntax. We have everything which you'd expect to be in Waxing Moon, and I can list them. There's blood and incest and noise and darkness and hunger, and if there's any kind of identity, it'll tend to be an animal identity rather than a human individual one. And then on the other side, as you let go of the collective and you surrender power, you reemerge as individuals, and now you've got cooking, marriage, marital sex, harmony between the sexes, as opposed to rebellion of women against, you know, against the male sex, and so on and so forth. Now, I'm simply saying, if the model's right, that should be reflected in the world's mythology. So you wouldn't expect the what I'm calling the on signal, ritual power switched on, which is Waxing Moon, in a myth. You wouldn't expect the on to be mixed up with the off, because what's going to happen then, if it does do that, you're going to lose the signal. If you mix matter and antimatter, you've just got zero. So the myths, true to prediction, they make sure that the signal is present. So in order to emphasize incest, you may have, for example, a woman is like, incest will be like, if a woman's having sex and it's incest, her partner will be a beast. It'll be a wolf, a bear, you know, because that makes the point about incest, because you know, being human is belongs to the other side of the equation, it's the off signal. If you're going to talk about food, you're going to be hungry, or even like even further than that, you actually are the meal. You're actually being eaten up by the wolf or the bear, you know. So a whole lot of things like incest, wet, blood, darkness, hunger, all go in the same category. They're all different ways of amplifying what I call the on signal. And then on the other side, like separate from that, you've got the off signal. And that, in a fairy tale, that'll be the end of the story. Or maybe the beginning as well, but it certainly won't be the middle of the story. So the stories are quite simple. It's this world, you then die, you go into the other world. The other world's got consistent qualities. In the other world, you don't have marriage. St. Thomas says it. There's no marriage in heaven. You don't feast on roast beef. In the other world, you hang upside down. There's a lot of, I don't know, a whole lot of things which apply to the other world, and you're dead. And it's not particularly magical to go from life to death, but now you have the really magical thing. You come back from the dead. And the signals to indicate you're back from the dead are consistent. You know, they all live happily ever after. You know, they get married. I don't know, a whole lot of things, but it's absolutely clear what's going on. And by the way, one of my students, Jason Wilcox, did a scholarly analysis as is a part of his postgraduate degree of modern horror films. The modern horror films, with absolute astonishing accuracy, follow the same syntax. They follow the same syntax. Even, I don't know, a silly film, not even horror film, like Jurassic Park. You know, Jurassic Park, it's like you wouldn't have had those dinosaurs cannibalistically, you know, trampling around, smelling blood and eating people, you know, with a blue sky and little cotton wool clouds. It had to be a storm, it had to be a thunder, a whole lot of things, you know, which make the thing work. And any audience is kind of at some level aware. They were brought up in fairy stories, or even they've read some other, you know, book or seen some other horror film. And if you get it wrong, if the person, you know, writing the script of the film gets it wrong, it just won't be a box office success. It just won't. It won't resonate. It won't. You just think, why are these dinosaurs eating people? And there's a nice blue sunny sky, blue, you know, cotton wool clouds. You should be having a picnic, you know. So it will find it works. You really will find it works.
Well, the other thing I liked about it is that you look at a whole series of physical attributes of human beings, which are on the face of it bizarre. We stand up. We're hairless. The whole description of the fact that women hide their sexual availability as opposed to the displaying it.
Conceal the ovulation,
And it completely reverses the way I'd always thought of things. You know, because I remember when I was very, well, I must have been quite young. Yes, it was in 1967, wasn't it? The Naked Ape?
Yes,
and I remember reading that as a teenager and thinking, gosh, wow, you know, I never thought of human beings like this before.
I read that as well.
It was a great, it was a turn on for me, really.
Of course it was. Women walk along with high heels so they can wiggle their buttocks.
that kind of thing. But I suppose a lot of it's wrong, but on the other hand, as a teenager, you know, suddenly having this kind of, in quotes, scientific way of looking at human beings. And let's look at human beings and animals. There's all sorts of odd things about them. How do we explain that?
Tesla Morris isn't a fool. I mean, on the one hand, he's quite a good biologist. On the other one, he has to sell books. And they can aid stock.
It's a good title.
You can take it. It's a good title. You can take it a bit far. He doesn't even begin to claim to deal with the origin of religion or kinship or language or whatever, all those things. It's just dealing with, you know, being a naked ape. I was perfectly happy with that. If you draw idiotic conclusions about cultural behaviour from the naked ape stuff, it'd be stupid. But I always use that as a baseline. I thought, okay, we started as naked apes, so how come you've got, I don't know, celibacy? How come you've got rules against, you know, sex with your mother-in-law? I mean, how can I, all these things. I mean, the naked ape thing doesn't explain all those things. But I was just, I almost took naked ape as my point of departure. I thought, but what makes us human? He told us what makes a naked ape. Now what makes us distinctively human? And that was a big challenge.